Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. It's a pleasure to be in front of your honors this morning. Just a brief introduction. At council table, I have with me Dawn Crompton, who's a law clerk with our office. She's working on satisfying her clerkship requirements to become admitted to the Delaware Bar.
Good luck. Welcome.
On remand, the Court of Chancery ruled in Wimbledon's favor when it considered the record as supplemented, as set forth in the remand order, and ruled that SV was not entitled to summary judgment. In its post-remand supplemental briefing to this court, SV admits that this ruling was correct and that it is not entitled to summary judgment if the supplemental evidence is considered. My argument today should stop and end here. However, the Court of Chancery went beyond its mandate and the instructions in the remand order and ruled that the supplemental evidence should not be considered under Court of Chancery Rule 60. The court then took it another step further and ruled that any alteration to its original summary judgment order should be conditioned on Wimbledon paying all of SV's fees and costs from the time that SV filed its cross-motion for summary judgment to the present. The Court of Chancery exceeded its mandate when it issued these extraneous rulings, and they should not be upheld by this court. The Court of Chancery exceeded its mandate when it determined that the record could not be supplemented under Rule 60. In the remand order, this court stated as follows: this matter should be remanded to the Court of Chancery so that the record can be supplemented with the evidence proffered to this court by Wimbledon. This court further stated, the Court of Chancery in the first instance should address the legal and factual issues in the record as supplemented. After considering the supplemented record, the Court of Chancery should report its findings of fact and conclusions of law to this court. This court also cited three cases in a footnote in the remand order. In these three cases, the court remanded to the trial court to ascertain facts based on new evidence that was submitted to this court on appeal, and which this court determined in the interest of justice should be considered by this court.
Well, let's review for a moment the prior proceedings, and then I want to ask you a question. You wanted to supplement the record in this court originally, and that motion was denied. It's denied because the record in this court and in the United States is closed once there's an appeal. And one of the reasons is it's unfair to reverse a trial judge who didn't consider evidence that you never showed to the trial judge. So we said, no, we're not going to supplement the record. But obviously, your evidence struck a responsive chord with the court because it seemed probative. And this court concluded the Court of Chancery should look at it in the first instance. So we sent it back. And the Court of Chancery said all the things you attributed to it, but it also said on your original motion for summary judgment, the court said you haven't taken much discovery, and you want me to rule in your favor. Do you have anything else? And you said no. And then it turns out that this document you now presented to our court in the Court of Chancery, you had all along. Now, admittedly, the other side had it too, but you basically asked the Court of Chancery to rule because you were content with a very limited record, and then when you didn't prevail, you expanded the record with this court's help on remand. My question is, under those circumstances where you said you were content with the record, you lost. And it turns out there was a document in existence that you had. Why isn't it fair for you to pay the other side's fees for having gone through the Court of Chancery and this court twice?
Okay, first of all, I just want to apologize because I jumped right in and didn't go over any of the background. So
I apologize. We understand all the background, but my question is, you agreed to submit it on a limited record. You had a document in your possession that turned out to be probative not only to our court, but to the Court of Chancery in the interest of justice. So while we're talking about the interest of justice, since you didn't present the document you had, why shouldn't you have to pay the other side's fees?
Well, first of all, I want to note that we were here on appeal saying that the Court of Chancery erred when it entered summary judgment in favor of SV. Even though the court was dealing with cross motions for summary judgment, it still had an obligation to deny SV's motion if there was a genuine issue of fact, which we contended existed based on the September letter that said that we, acknowledging the June 30th withdrawal date and saying that we will pay you in kind and not in cash. So that was our argument in what I've been calling round one here. And we stand by that argument. Now, I wish that I was not in the position that I'm in today, and I distinctly remember being on vacation in Barcelona when I received an email from my client saying, I found these documents. I wish that wasn't the case. It's not ideal, but my client came to me with these documents that, as Your Honor has pointed out, are highly probative to the issue in front of this court and in front of the Court of Chancery, documents which SV or its agents prepared, which it knew about since the beginning of this action. And I had a duty to my client to bring those documents to the court. And, you know, like I said, it's not an ideal situation, but I had that duty. We are where we are. And the prejudice to SV of having to go through this whole process, I feel, is negated because of the fact that these are its own documents. It prepared these documents. It's taken positions in front of the Court of Chancery and in front of this court that contradict what the information that's in these documents. There's a K-1. The K-1 is an official communication between a partnership and its partners. It prepared that document, or it was prepared on its behalf, and it shows that Wimbledon withdrew all of its capital in 2008.
Let's assume all of that is true. What I believe Justice Holland is asking you is, because your client had that information in its possession, why shouldn't it have to pay attorney's fees? Because the result would have been different had it got it to the information to you before you went to Barcelona, or in any event in a more timely way, you would have been aware of it and you would have raised it in the first instance. This isn't a criticism of you. You're not paying these fees. Your client is, because your client didn't timely disclose that information to you so you could use it appropriately. No one questions it. If had you had it, you would have presented it. I think no one is. Is your argument in response to his question that because the other side had it as well and actually crafted it, owned it, publicly disseminated it, that they were under an equal duty to bring it to the attention of the court, and therefore you shouldn't have to pay their attorney's fees?
They were at least under an equal duty to not take positions that directly contradict documents that it prepared.
Is it your position is similar to disclosing to the court a case that's contrary to the legal position that they're taking?
I suppose it could be similar to that type of situation, or even if...
Would they have disclosed it had there been discovery directed to them, which would have compelled them under the rules to disclose it?
If there had been discovery, it would have...
But there wasn't. Well, I'm trying to feel my way through this. If there wasn't discovery, which would have compelled them under the rule to disclose it unilaterally, even if your clients had it in their file somewhere, is that something different than the suggestion that because they had it in their possession, that's the excuse for not having your client pay attorney's fees because they didn't give it to you in a timely way?
I think they're two separate points. The fact that they prepared them and the fact that they took positions contrary to the information that's in those documents.
Well, but that's your conclusion, that information is contrary. Their position is it really isn't. It depends on how you read it. not a strange argument to us, not an unusual or unique argument. People don't always read writing the same way. They draw different inferences. Surprisingly, usually the inference that's most favorable to the outcome they want. So we can't just automatically conclude that it's contrary to their position because they wouldn't agree with you on that, correct?
Right. Well, there's at least an issue of fact as to whether
so
it's
So your contrary. Precise answer to Justice Holland's question is we shouldn't have to pay the attorney's fees because, and you fill in the blank.
Because these documents were prepared by and in SV's possession during the entire course of this litigation. And not only that, but I don't think that, you know, we follow the American rule here where unless there is a contract or there's a statute, a party's not awarded attorney's fees. I don't think this is bad faith conduct. SV admits in its brief that, you know, we're not talking about bad faith here, which is another basis for awarding fees. This relationship between these parties is governed by a contract which does not have an attorney's fee provision, and the court should not alter that contractual bargain.
Is it in essence that the fault for not producing this is shared?
I don't want to admit that the fault is shared because Wimbledon has consistently maintained that it withdrew as of June 30th, 2008.
Well, I know that you wanted to win based on the limited record you presented. But the fact of the matter is, and the other side might have been thinking to themselves, wow, isn't that great? They didn't ask for discovery. Glad we didn't have to produce those K-1s because that certainly would have created a material issue of fact. And then they engaged on the limited record that you were satisfied with and prevailed. So the what concerned the chancellor and the reason I want to pursue this is because the chancellor said you had a chance to develop the record and you didn't request any discovery. You just wanted to win on the point that you still would like to win on, and I understand that. But the fact is, the chancellor said, not having engaged in any discovery, when you come back later on with something that's really significant, the chancellor's position is that's what these rules are all about. And if you decide not to take discovery and submit the case to the court based on a limited record, you're stuck with your limited record. And as far as the vice chancellor's concerned, that should be the end of the case. Now, in the interest of justice, you know, now that our Court of Chancery, have seen these documents you found, it's not unlike the dilemma we have with the statute of limitations, where a person has a great case that is barred by the statute of limitations. But this is different. You have an arguable case based on the evidence that you had and you've now shared with both courts. But the key question is, why shouldn't there be some obligation on your client's part if it now wants to go to trial on the merits on an expanded record to compensate everybody for the time and effort they had to go through because your client wanted it decided on a limited record?
Well, I think that type of ruling would encourage parties to hide the ball.
Or request discovery.
Yes.
Not altogether a bad thing to request discovery.
No, it's not. But here we were dealing with the contract. We had evidence. We went forward on that basis. We discovered the supplemental evidence. We put it forward. It was prepared by SV. It's directly contradicted by their position throughout this entire litigation. They've known about it. They hid the ball, and now they're going to
Well, they didn't hide the ball if no one said, show us the ball. That's why the Chief Justice said, if you want to make an argument, it would seem more analogous to say they had an affirmative duty based on the evidence they had that was never requested to be produced, not to take a contrary position with something they knew wasn't supported by evidence. That would be something in the interest of justice that would concern the court, but that you didn't embrace the Chief Justice's helpful question.
Well, I understand the court's concern, and as I stated earlier, we were content to rely on the September letter. We still think that creates an issue of fact that precluded summary judgment. We came across these documents. We had to present them to the court, given their probative value. They were prepared by SV or its agents or on its behalf. It had to have known about these documents. The positions that they've taken throughout this litigation are not supported by these documents at all. And if the case had been in discovery and we had discovered these documents and SV and then compared it to the positions that SV had taken, I would have to think that there would be, the court would not look favorably upon that.
But is there other relief you seek other than a reversal of the decision on fees?
Assuming that everyone, that we're all on the same page, that the Chancellor Strine was directed to consider the supplemental evidence and decide whether or not summary judgment was appropriate, assuming that we're all on the same page that that was what he was supposed to do, then yes, the only issue really is the fees. And the fees were kind of thrown in the last conclusion paragraph in the remand opinion, and there was no rule, there was no citation, there was no analysis. It was just, if my original ruling is changed or altered, then SV is entitled to fees, which would mean that if this court, after considering the probative evidence that's in front of you, determines that summary judgment is inappropriate, then SV should then be entitled to fees.
Do you agree that even if the Chancellor exceeded the mandate, that this court could on its own determine that those fees should be paid?
This court would have the authority to make that determination.
And this is not an interlocutory appeal? Is this, let me ask it a different way, isn't this something that should wait until final judgment?
Well, it depends, because the way I read the Court of Chancery's order is that if this case is sent back down to the Court of Chancery for trial, then that will be an alteration of Chancellor Strine's original summary judgment order, which would then entitle SV to fees. Now, perhaps he could change his mind, I don't know, but that is his ruling in the opinion.
Okay. You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Richard Rank with the law firm of Ashby & Geddes. My firm represents the defendant below, SV Special Situations Fund, LP. Before I get started, I do want to introduce again Mr. Cordo from our office, who's with me today.
Welcome.
Your Honor, it appears that the attorney's fees issue has caught most of the bench's attention, and so I'll start there this morning.
Before you go there,
okay.
And what's your response to the contention that relates to the attorney's fees, and that your litigation position was inconsistent with evidence you knew existed but had never been the subject of a request for discovery?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a couple of assumptions in there that they have made, but I don't necessarily think are correct at this point. I think the Chief Justice picked up on one, is that I don't think that you can read the three documents that they've put in front of the court or the courts and come to the concrete conclusion that those three documents clearly spell out a waiver of the lockup provision.
All right. Well, let's assume hypothetically they're pretty close to that. Okay.
Well, and I agree. And if they're pretty close, then I think that defendants are allowed to argue what those documents mean. And I don't think that this is the same. There has been this kind of flavor throughout the briefing on this that there has been some type of unethical conduct by either my client or myself here. And I don't.
No. I don't think they're saying that. I think they're saying each side didn't pay particularly close attention to documents that were in existence. And if everybody would have paid better attention, maybe we wouldn't have had two proceedings. Because what it says is, their client said we'd like out in June. K-1s go to everybody else that says these people are out as of June. But in the meantime, you've got the Court of Chancery construing a September letter and the implications of whether they're in, they're out, were they explicitly out, implicitly out, or whatever. So putting aside any pejorative attribution to anybody's motives here, the question is, should the fault be shared, which means everybody pays their own attorney's fees, or does one side have the better argument that your opponent should pay your fees for putting you through this?
I think it's you can't share the fault, and I think the better argument is that we're not at fault here. Your Honor, Justice Holland, you asked the question, and you've picked up exactly on how this kind of came about when you asked, perhaps the defendants were just happy when you moved to dismiss or when you moved for summary judgment right away. We weren't, we were surprised mostly because we had just answered, there was this defense out there, but it could have easily been remedied by a amended complaint. So, there wasn't much sense in moving to dismiss under 12b-6 that on something that could be as easily remedied as just pleading this waiver. And so we thought that this would go to discovery, and then at some proper time there would probably be summary judgment practice on this. But it would depend.
Is there any significance to the circumstance that upon our remand order that you did not ask this court to amend that order to allow the chancellor to consider attorney's fees?
Well, Your Honor, I think
this is... ask us to amend the order to order the chancellor to consider attorney's fees.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's because we felt similar to the last question that was asked, of my colleague here, is that I'm not sure that it's really ripe yet, although this court could do this and order the fees, but our view is probably the better option is that the court should decide the merits of the actual appeal here, and then, with the attorney's fees, we can either move when we get back to, if we're back in the Court of Chancery, we can move for those fees. He'll either grant them or he won't, and if he does, then it would be an appealable issue in due course.
But help me work through that. And we had a final judgment on appeal. It was remanded to the Court of Chancery, and this court retained jurisdiction. So what we still have before us is an appeal from the final judgment in favor of your client. But now, during the remand, where the record was supplemented at our direction, it appears summary judgment was inappropriate based on the expanded record. So it goes back for a trial. The question is, when you come to award attorney's fees, if your client prevails, that would be one solution. But if the other side prevails, is your answer that even if they prevail, they should have to pay our fees for the right to have a trial? The fees that would follow that preceding the trial.
I think I understand Your Honor's question, and I think the answer is yes, because this isn't a loser and you've lost, you have to pay the other side's attorney's fees situation. Our view of this has been, and I think the Chancellor's view of this, was that when our side, when they moved for summary judgment without taking any discovery, and then our side cross-moved, raising the issue of the lockup, it was really incumbent on Wimbledon to come forth with the evidence that it thought it had or that it needed to show a waiver. And it came to the Chancellor, the Court of Chancery with the one document, and when the Chancellor asked them point blank, you know, well, why didn't you take discovery? Well, we thought we could stand on this September 30th letter. You know, we think that this proceeding would have been vastly different had, and I don't think it would have come nearly this far, had they come back and answered our motion for summary judgment with the three letters or the three documents that they have now. You know, I think we haven't fought the issue that the alternative holding below on remand, that if you look at the three, it probably gets you past the summary judgment standard.
One of the issues that I'm having difficulty with is the principled basis for awarding attorney's fees here. It was correctly stated by your colleague that traditionally the American rule is founded in contract, statute, or bad faith. Otherwise, each party bears their own expenses, regardless of what happens. And then an overlay of that is Rule 11, where a court believes that a party has intentionally, in effect, obstructed the administration of justice in the particular case in some way that can only be remedied by invoking Rule 11. This case strikes me as somewhere in the middle of the two. And my question is, from where does the authority come to strike what amounts to a new rule on a principled basis that doesn't go to Rule 11 and cannot track any of the three traditional rule-shifting bases?
Your Honor,
where does this come?
I understand, Your Honor, and I think I agree with you that it is somewhere in between. It certainly is not a Rule 11 type issue. It doesn't, you know, and it doesn't have a statute. But I think that even though he didn't say it, I think where the Chancellor's coming from here is the idea that, and there is case law out there where, you know, if you have done something to unnecessarily prolong or unnecessarily make litigation more expensive, the courts have on occasion granted the shifting of attorney's fees for that taking those acts that made litigation more expensive.
But if the American rule is going to have any substance to it, my understanding has been that it has to be something egregious that would subject the party to a Rule 11 sanction. It can't be just, even though I'm sitting as a vice chancellor in a court of equity, it doesn't mean that I'm Zeus. I don't have all the powers I want to have on a particular situation. There's got to be some structure to my rational basis for making a judgment of one kind or another. I'm trying to figure out what it is here. I understand completely that it seems fair on the surface. They caused other issues to be raised. They caused you to do work arguably you shouldn't have had to do. And it strikes one as that's really unfortunate for your client to have to fund your fees for unnecessary work. That is the fault of their client, not of counsel. I get that. But I need to find something that justifies it as a matter of law, some principled basis for it.
Well, Your Honor, I think we would say that this is egregious enough to do it in this case, because our client has spent over $70,000 on the back and forth over the summary judgment phase, where if we had had these three documents up front, we probably never would have been down this path. They came to the summary judgment, they filed the first summary judgment motion.
When you say if you had these three documents up front, you mean if they had presented them in support of their motion for summary judgment, because you had them.
Well, we clearly had I had the September 30th letter. I read it the same way that the Chancellor did down below. I never thought that that was a waiver, so we didn't raise that in the motion. They raised it. We argued about it below. That was the first document. The second document that they presented was this September 29th HSBC letter. As we told them below, it's not, we haven't had a chance to, really flesh this out and fight it out because we haven't taken any discovery. My clients have never seen that. They say they've never seen it. So to say that we had that second letter is a bit of a conclusion that I'm not sure is going to be borne out later. The K-1, I don't think we can argue that we don't have that. I'd be surprised if that's not in our files. But again, I go back to kind of where we were. We were 2 weeks after filing an answer when they filed the motion for summary judgment. I'm not sure, under what principles. I'm not sure it's the practice, that the defendants go and preemptively, gather all their documents prior to discovery requests. That's what we assumed was going to be the next thing coming, and we would have gone through this process. So, I'd hate to see what comes out of this is some requirement that all of a sudden, you know, defendants are going to have to go defendants are going to have to go gather all the documents prior to having any kind of discovery request. Now, I suspect that, you know, they would have drafted discovery requests that would have covered these documents. To the extent they were in my client's files, they would have been produced.
Didn't the chancellor impose a condition that this court did not impose, attorney's fees?
Well, I think he's tried to impose it.
And if so, are you asking us to award attorney's fees now?
My argument, Your Honor, would be that this court should leave the attorney's fees alone for now and let us, you know, present it the way I think it probably should be presented. Present it down at the trial court first. If he rules on it and there is a final judgment about fees, either that comes as an interlocutory issue that we do down below or whether it's at the end of the case sometime, then it would, I think, would be properly teed up and Your Honors could deal with it then. I think the better issue and, you know, what I would hope would happen is that this court, to the extent that it has, you know, has determined its remand order was directing the chancellor to consider that evidence on the merits, I would hope that you might reconsider that because we do think that the Rule 60 mechanism is the best way to, or the best prism with when to look at this evidence. So, you know, I'd be remiss with, you know, for my clients if I didn't try to talk you off that position to the extent that's where you are.
I understand that, but one could argue that the chancellor has put us in the position of, we told you to do this. You said, I really don't think it's a good idea for me to do this, so I'm not going to do it. Where does that leave us?
Well, I understand the predicament, Your Honor. And, I don't think either I or Ms. Inirio or the chancellor know for sure what the three judges on this panel intended when they sent that down. I think the order was susceptible for a couple of different readings.
You think there was something ambiguous about it?
Well, apparently three of us have read it three different ways. So,
what if the three of us all read it the same way?
I suspect you do, Your Honor, and that's, you know, if you have decided that this should have been heard on its merits, like I said, we've agreed that if you look at the three documents, they get past the summary judgment stage. We disagree completely that those three documents, you know, at the end of the day are going to carry their water for them. But, you know, we would not be able to really argue that those three documents still.
So if I understand your position, if this order of remand meant consider this evidence on the merits, and considering on the merits precludes summary judgment, then this case should be remanded for further proceedings, including discovery, and that with regard to attorney's fees, our court should say the issue of the attorney's fees should be decided as all attorney's fees requests are decided at the end of the litigation.
You know, I would love for my client to get an order out of this court that said the fees were going to get paid, but I don't know that at the end of the day that's really, you know, in my view, the way this should come down. As I said, I think, you know, Your Honors could deal with the arguments that, you know, the substantive arguments about, you know, summary judgment and, you know, politely decline to impose the condition, you know, with the idea that, you know, it's just not ripe yet.
Okay.
Your Honor, I think that's all I have. I appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Just a few points very briefly. I just wanted to note, I know this is in our briefs, and it's in the record, just want to note that when I received these documents from my client, my first, the first thing I did was contacted SV's counsel. We didn't run to court first. We contacted SV's counsel and said, we've located these documents. Let's try to work something out. That didn't happen, and here we are today. I also want to note that both sides have been paying fees throughout this process. This is not a one-sided issue where SV has solely had to expend more fees than we've had because of what's transpired. Both sides have been paying fees. The Court of Chancery's attorney's fee decision exceeds the mandate of the remand order. That's briefed in our papers. If this court does not address this issue at this point, then the Court of Chancery's ruling that any alteration to its original summary judgment decision will result in Wimbledon being obligated to pay SV's fees will stand. And unless Your Honors have any other further questions, I don't have anything further.
Apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.